April 12, 1994. Carlisle, Pennsylvania. While driving from Oklahoma to New Jersey to see her friend Melissa Shepherd, 23-year-old Karen Denise Wells checks into a motel. Denise phones Melissa and asks her to come meet her there, but when Melissa arrives, Denise has vanished. Later that morning, Denise's abandoned rental car is discovered 35 miles away on a rural road with an empty gas tank, and there are 700 miles on the vehicle's odometer, which cannot be accounted for. Discrepancies eventually open up in Melissa's story, leading to speculation that she is withholding information about Denise's disappearance, but no trace of Denise is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and we've got a very bizarre missing persons case to cover today. The 1994 disappearance of Karen Denise Wells. This case is a suggestion from a listener named Jason, and since I recently saw a thread about it on the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, I thought it would be an ideal time to do an episode. This isn't a particularly well-known missing persons case, but it's a pretty baffling one. It involves a woman who embarked on a lengthy road trip from Oklahoma to New Jersey to see a friend, until she disappeared after checking into a motel in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. I'm always fascinated by cases in which people go missing or wind up dead at locations they had no reason to be at, and this is one of the stranger ones. In this story, the victim's movements don't seem to make a lot of sense, as before she arrived at the motel, Denise was spotted in locations which were much closer to her destination in New Jersey, so there was no apparent reason for her to circle back and wind up in Carlisle. But the strangest detail is that when Denise's abandoned rental car was discovered, investigators were able to add up all the mileage and determine that there were around 700 miles on the odometer which could not be accounted for. This seemed to indicate that Denise had gone out of her way to travel to some additional locations during her trip, and it would eventually become apparent that her friend in New Jersey probably knew more than she was telling. But to this day, no one has been able to determine where those additional 700 miles came from or what actually happened to Denise. So I'm really going to be racking my brain trying to figure out what happened in this case. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the baffling disappearance of Karen Denise Wells. Our story begins in 1994, and our central figure is 23-year-old Karen Denise Wells, who goes by the name Denise. Denise lives in her hometown of Haskell, Oklahoma, and is raising an 18-month-old son named William. Denise was known as being a bit of a wild teenager, and after graduating high school, she moved to South Dakota to live with her aunt. While there, Denise ran into a few problems, including a criminal conviction for check forgery, for which she received a sentence of probation. By the time she returned to Haskell, Denise was pregnant with William. While there's no information out there about who the child's father was, it sounds like he was completely out of the picture by this point, and Denise would end up raising William as a single mother. She got a part-time job at Haskell Airport, and while Denise eventually found herself unemployed, she was apparently handling her situation quite well and was known for being a very loving parent. However, on the afternoon of April 10th, Denise made the surprising decision to go on a 1,300-mile cross-country road trip. Her destination was North Bergen, New Jersey, where she was planning to visit an old high school friend of hers named Melissa Shepherd. Melissa now made her living as an exotic dancer, and according to Denise, she was depressed and experiencing quote-unquote personal problems, so Denise wanted to persuade Melissa to return back home to Haskell in order to get her life straightened out. Denise would leave William with her parents and told them she expected to be gone between 4 days to a week. While the amount of total driving time from Haskell to North Bergen was over 20 hours, Denise was apparently planning to make the entire trip non-stop. And even though she owned a car, Denise drove to Tulsa in order to rent a 1993 Plymouth Acclaim for the drive, leaving her own vehicle at the rental place. Unfortunately, Denise would become a missing person just over 2 days later, and a number of perplexing questions would emerge about her road trip. Shortly before 6 p.m. on the evening of April 12th, Denise arrived in the town of Carlisle, located in Middlesex Township, Pennsylvania, and checked into the Pike Motel. She told the owner that she only needed a place to sleep for 2 or 3 hours and was given a reduced rate on a room, as well as long-distance telephone service. After entering the room, Denise received some phone calls from Melissa Shepherd. About a half hour earlier, Denise had called Melissa from a payphone at a nearby gas station. According to Melissa, Denise claimed she was exhausted as she had repeatedly gotten lost on her trip. Denise did not believe she would be able to make it all the way to North Bergen on her own, and since Carlisle was still around 200 miles away, she had decided to check into the motel so that Melissa could meet her there and accompany her the rest of the way. Denise said she was planning to grab something to eat at McDonald's and would go to bed and grab some sleep before Melissa arrived. After Denise ended the call, she went to the motel owner to ask to borrow some matches, but this would turn out to be the last time she was confirmed to be alive. According to the owner, she later received a call from a woman claiming to be a friend of Denise's, asking for directions to the motel. Sometime between midnight and 1 a.m. on April 13th, Melissa finally arrived at the hotel and was accompanied by two male companions. After knocking on the door to Denise's room and receiving no answer, Melissa went to see the owner and asked her to call the room's phone. Once again, there was no answer, so the owner had her husband unlock the door and let Denise and her male companions inside the room. While Denise's room key, luggage, and all of her possessions were there, Denise herself was nowhere to be found. Some clothing was found on the floor, which gave off the impression that Denise may have dropped them while changing clothes. There was also a cigarette in the ashtray, which was the same brand Denise liked, and while it appeared to have been lit, it was not smoked. Even though Denise had intended to get some sleep during her stay, the bed did not appear to have been slept in. There were no noticeable signs of a struggle, and the motel owners did not recall seeing or hearing anything unusual that night, but Melissa became concerned and soon filed a missing persons report with the Middlesex Township Police Department. Later that morning at around 5:50 a.m., Denise's Plymouth Acclaim was discovered abandoned in a rural area on Route 274. The location was 35 miles from the Pike Motel in Perry County near New Germantown and in close proximity to the Tuscarora State Forest. The car was parked in the middle of the westbound lane and both its driver's and passenger side doors were wide open. It had run out of gas and the battery was dead, and the vehicle was also scratched and splattered with mud. A number of items were found inside, including Denise's driver's license, birth certificate, and a probation card from her previous forgery conviction. The car also contained cigarette butts, paper cups, and some McDonald's French fries, as well as wrappers for McDonald's and other fast food restaurants. Most interestingly, there were also small amounts of marijuana inside, a pipe for smoking marijuana, and traces of what the newspaper accounts described as quote-unquote suspected cocaine. Denise's purse, which still had a small amount of cash inside, was discovered in a nearby ditch, but one item which could not be found were the keys to the car. A massive search involving dogs and helicopters would be conducted of the surrounding area and forest, but it failed to turn up any trace of Denise. However, the one aspect of her disappearance which left police completely baffled was the odometer in her car. Since it was a rental, the company kept detailed records about the vehicle's mileage, but there turned out to be a major discrepancy. An average drive from Tulsa, Oklahoma to Carlisle, Pennsylvania would have been just under 1,200 miles, but when investigators tracked all of Denise's known movements and tabulated all the mileage, they determined that there were around 700 miles on the odometer which could not be accounted for. If that wasn't enough, once Denise's disappearance received publicity, a witness came forward who reported interacting with her at approximately 11:30 a.m. on the morning of April 12th. According to the witness, he had pulled over to help a woman matching Denise's description because her vehicle had run out of gas and was stranded by the side of the road. However, this took place in Lebanon County, Pennsylvania, near Schaeferstown, over 50 miles east of Carlisle. Even stranger, when the witness helped the woman get gas, she mentioned that she had been to New Jersey and was heading towards Oklahoma, so he gave her directions for two separate routes which took her west. So if Denise was on her way home, why did she check into the Pike Motel 6 hours later, and why would she have needed Melissa to come meet her there and accompany her to North Bergen? 7 months after Denise went missing, the story took an even more bizarre turn. It turned out that Denise had been conducting an affair with a married man named Mike Douglas, who also happened to be the owner of Haskell Airport, Denise's previous employer. Around Thanksgiving, Mike Douglas's wife claimed that she received a phone call from a female who identified herself as Miss Wells and stated, quote, "This is Denise. Tell Mike I'm not coming home. I'm already married," end quote. While Mrs. Douglas thought the call sounded like Denise, police were skeptical that it was her. Virtually everyone who knew Denise insisted that she was very attached to her son William and would not have run away without attempting to contact him. At the time Denise originally went missing, Melissa Shepherd was very active in the search efforts for her. She stayed in close contact with Denise's family, underwent therapy to deal with her personal problems, and since she had no police record, Melissa was not initially considered a suspect. However, in April of 1995, around the one-year anniversary of Denise's disappearance, police publicly announced that after a thorough investigation, they had uncovered a significant amount of discrepancies in Melissa's story and expressed their belief that she knew more than she was telling. They published an exact timeline of Denise's movements during her final road trip, and there were a number of things which did not make much sense. Throughout the course of her trip, Denise called Melissa's home in North Bergen a number of times. The first phone call took place in Indianapolis on April 11th, and the second took place in the town of Somerset, Pennsylvania, at 6:39 a.m. on the morning of April 12th. These calls did not raise any red flags, as they seemed to correspond with the proper route and time frame of Denise's trip from Oklahoma. The next call from Denise to Melissa took place from a payphone in Schaeferstown at 11:39 a.m., shortly after the motorist helped her get gas, but the problem is that Denise subsequently called her at 3:34 p.m. from a payphone in Burnville, a small Pennsylvania town located in Berks County. Burnville is located approximately 17 miles northeast of Schaeferstown, so if the motorist had given her directions to head west, what was Denise doing there 4 hours later? And of course, Denise's next call to Melissa took place at 5:27 p.m., from a gas station near Carlisle, a 70-mile drive southwest of Burnville. Phone records would also show that a call was made to Melissa's home from Denise's motel room at 8:05 p.m., but since this was about an hour and a half after she was last seen, it cannot be confirmed if Denise herself made the call. However, the biggest red flag which could not be explained was a call which was made from a payphone at the Sheets Market in Middlesex Township to Melissa's number at 12:50 a.m. on April 12th, a full 17 hours before Denise supposedly arrived in the area and checked into the Pike Motel. The call went to Melissa's voicemail, but she could not, or would not, tell police who made the call or what it was about. But there would be a number of other troubling discrepancies in Melissa's story. Remember how I mentioned that she was accompanied by two male companions when she arrived at the motel and reported Melissa missing? Well, if you read the original media accounts of the case, they state that Melissa arrived at the motel with her boyfriend. That's the story she originally told police, but when the motel owners confirmed that there were two men with her, investigators learned that they were actually casual acquaintances she knew from the bar where she worked in North Bergen. Both men were subsequently interviewed by police and shared a bizarre story. Apparently, when they first arrived at the motel, Melissa, quote-unquote, went ballistic when she noticed that Denise's rental car was not parked outside, even though they had not even gone into her room yet and discovered that Denise was missing. Another weird contradiction was that when Melissa spoke to the media following Denise's disappearance to talk about the search efforts, she mentioned that they hadn't been checking bars for her since Denise did not drink or frequent them. Yet Melissa's male companions claimed that when they found out Denise was not at the motel, the first thing they did was search for her at some local bars. Melissa eventually stopped talking to the police and told them that she just wanted to put the incident behind her. In a 2009 article published about the case, the lead investigator mentioned that Melissa's current whereabouts at that time were unknown. Anyway, at one point, law enforcement met with the producers of Unsolved Mysteries in hopes of getting the case featured on the show, but just before they were about to enter the pre-production phase, the network executives ultimately decided not to produce a segment, feeling that the story just, quote-unquote, wasn't right for the show. DNA testing would eventually be performed on some of the items found in Denise's abandoned vehicle, including the cigarette butts and paper cups, but as far as I can tell, they failed to draw a match with anyone. In April of 2018, near the 24th anniversary of Denise's disappearance, a new article was published about the case by an ABC affiliate in Pennsylvania. It featured a photograph of Denise's now 25-year-old son William, who had been raised by his grandparents in her absence, and was now engaged to be married. But as the 25th anniversary of this case approaches, there is still no trace of Denise, and the exact circumstances of how she went missing remain a baffling mystery. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So like I mentioned in the intro, I'm always perplexed by cold cases in which a victim travels a great distance and either goes missing or winds up dead at a location they had no reason to visit. This story will probably bring back memories of the episode I did last year about the death of Jonathan Luna, an attorney who left his office in Baltimore late at night before he inexplicably took an all-night road trip, driving hundreds of miles through Delaware and New Jersey and winding up dead in a creek in rural Pennsylvania early the next morning. It's always been up for debate whether Luna was murdered or committed a very elaborate suicide, but no one has ever been able to figure out why he spent the entire night driving through multiple states to begin with. And here we have Karen Denise Wells, who went missing during a cross-country road trip from Oklahoma to New Jersey, and oddly enough, her abandoned car was found in rural Pennsylvania, around 90 miles away from where Luna was discovered. But while investigators were able to piece together most of Luna's exact movements during his road trip, there are still many pieces missing in Denise's trip, and of course the key difference is that Denise's body has still never been found. It's pretty frustrating that Unsolved Mysteries had initially planned to do a segment about this story, as one of their researchers spent a lot of time scouting locations, talking to people connected to the case, and putting together a rough outline for the segment. But then the bigwigs decided that the story just wasn't, quote-unquote, right for the show, and for the life of me, I have no idea why they came to that conclusion. This case is so baffling and has so many weird twists and turns that it would have been absolutely perfect for Unsolved Mysteries. But hey, later that same year, the show produced a segment about a woman who dreamt about her dead grandfather coming to visit her and telling her how much he loved French toast, which is infinitely more compelling. As much as I love Unsolved Mysteries, their episodes really did become oversaturated with paranormal-themed segments during the mid-90s, and it seems like a number of compelling true crime stories like this one got the shaft. The decision may have had something to do with the fact that the show did not have a great success rate at solving missing persons cases, as only 5 out of the 96 disappearances they profiled had been solved at that point. Regardless, it must have been a devastating blow for Denise's family, as getting her disappearance exposure on national television really could have given the case a major boost and helped fill in some of the major holes in this story. Anyway, like most of the other cases featured on the podcast involving inexplicable road trips, we'll have to start at the very beginning. We know that Denise decided to leave her hometown of Haskell, Oklahoma, in order to make a cross-country trip to see her childhood friend, Melissa Shepherd, in North Bergen, New Jersey. While she was gone, Denise left her infant son with her parents, but it sounds like she didn't provide them with many specific details about why she was visiting Melissa, except that it was to help her with some quote-unquote personal problems. But right from the outset, there were a number of red flags about this trip. For starters, since Denise owned her own vehicle, why did she rent a Plymouth Acclaim? Keep in mind that Denise was unemployed at this point, and raising a child as a single mother, so I have a feeling she wouldn't have had that much money. Paying for enough gas to make a 1,300-mile cross-country road trip would be expensive enough, but forking out money on a rental car as well is even more costly. And while there's been a lot of talk about the inconsistencies in the timeline of Denise's travels through Pennsylvania, there's another odd inconsistency from Oklahoma, which I've never really seen addressed. When police published the official timeline in the Carlisle Sentinel newspaper after Denise went missing, it stated that she left her home in Haskell at 2 p.m. on April 10th and rented a car in Tulsa at 9:30 p.m. Since it only takes around 40 minutes to drive from Haskell to Tulsa, why is there a gap of 7.5 hours? It's also odd that Denise would decide to leave on her trip that late at night rather than wait until the following morning, which seems to indicate she wanted to get to North Bergen as quickly as possible. All these peculiarities has led to some speculation that Melissa may have convinced Denise to become involved in illegal activity, such as drug trafficking. Strangely enough, only a few days before I recorded this, I saw the new Clint Eastwood movie, The Mule, in which he plays an ordinary senior citizen who finds himself in such a financial bind that he agrees to drive shipments of cocaine across the country for drug dealers. The April 16, 1994 edition of the Carlisle Sentinel specifically mentions that police found small amounts of marijuana and quote-unquote suspected cocaine in Denise's rental car. Melissa Shepherd is then immediately quoted as saying, "She smoked a little pot every now and then, but cocaine? No way. Absolutely no way." End quote. Given the inconsistencies which later popped up in Melissa's story, you could read a lot into her becoming so defensive over the idea that Denise might have used cocaine. Now, I really hate to accuse a missing victim of being a drug mule, given that there isn't much hard evidence to support this, but you can see how someone might believe this is the case. I know that Denise was a very loving mother, and had apparently turned around her wild ways from her teen years, but she did have a previous conviction for check forgery, so she wasn't immune to breaking the law. And of course, Denise was also unemployed at that time, and if she was desperate enough for money, I could see her getting roped into doing something she ordinarily wouldn't do. The expense of renting a car and paying for gas on a long cross-country trip might have been worth it if there was going to be a substantial payoff at the end. But let's get back to talking about the logistics of Denise's trip from Oklahoma to New Jersey. She apparently gave her parents the impression that she was going to make the entire trip without stopping, which considering that she left Tulsa at 9:30 at night, seems pretty insane. Now, Tulsa is Central Time, so theoretically, if Denise left there at 9:30 p.m. and made the entire trip on the interstate, it should have taken between 20 to 21 hours, and she would have arrived in North Bergen sometime on the evening of April 11th. Investigators were able to track Denise's movements by phone records, and the first leg of her trip does make logical sense. She called Melissa from Indianapolis sometime on April 11th, and you can make it from Tulsa to Indianapolis in about 9.5 hours on Interstate 44, and by turning east on Interstate 70 in St. Louis. We then know that Denise phoned Melissa during the early morning hours of April 12th from Somerset, Pennsylvania, which is just over 6 hours east of Indianapolis via the I-70. Now, one piece of information which hasn't been made clear is if Denise stopped at any other motels during her trip, other than the Pike Motel in Carlisle. I know Denise looked completely exhausted when she arrived there on April the 12th, which seemed to indicate that she had been driving 2 straight days, but it's also possible that she could have pulled over somewhere to sleep in her car rather than check into a motel. The fact that Denise called Melissa from Somerset at 6:39 a.m. is a sign that she might have just woken up before resuming her trip, but it's Denise's movements after this call which have caused immense confusion. Okay, the next confirmed sighting of Denise was about 170 miles east from Somerset, near Schaeferstown, at 11:30 a.m., when she ran out of gas and was helped by a motorist on Route 19. Technically, this location is along the route from Somerset to North Bergen, so it would make sense for Denise to be there, but the strange part is that she told the motorist who pulled over to help her that she had already been to New Jersey and was heading west back to Oklahoma. I know that eyewitnesses in missing persons cases can sometimes be mistaken, but I'm pretty certain that this motorist really did interact with Denise, since she specifically mentioned Oklahoma, and phone records show that Denise made a call to Melissa's place from Schaeferstown around this exact time. Now, given what Denise told the motorist, you might assume that perhaps she had already gone to see Melissa in New Jersey and was now heading back home. However, when you look at the exact timeline, that does not seem physically possible. It takes nearly 5 hours to drive from Somerset to North Bergen, and since only 5 hours elapsed between Denise's 2 phone calls, she would not have been able to drive to North Bergen and make it back to Schaeferstown in time for her 11:39 phone call. I was inclined to think the motorist misunderstood Denise, and she actually told him she was heading from Oklahoma to New Jersey, but then again, he did give her directions for routes to head west, so I'm not sure there was a misunderstanding. Whatever the case, there really doesn't seem to be any logical explanation for Denise to be making a phone call to Melissa in Burnville nearly 4 hours later, as it was about 20 miles northeast in the opposite direction. It would only take her about a half hour to drive there, so unless Denise got really, really lost and was aimlessly driving around, where was she during that 4 hour window of time? Of course, you have to keep in mind that this was the pre-GPS era of 1994, and Denise had probably never driven through Pennsylvania before, so if she took a wrong turn somewhere, it's not hard to imagine her getting lost. Whatever the case, if Denise was still planning to travel to North Bergen when she made the phone call from Burnville, she went in the complete wrong direction when she traveled 70 miles west to Carlisle. If Denise was genuinely lost, I suppose this could have been the last straw which compelled her to check into the Pike Motel and ask Melissa to come meet her there in order to guide her the rest of the way. The motel owner did confirm that Denise was only planning to stay in the room for a couple of hours, which supports the idea that she was going to use this opportunity to get some sleep while waiting for Melissa to arrive. On the surface, this scenario does make sense, but the major obstacle which cannot be overlooked are the 700 unaccounted for miles on the rental car's odometer. Even if Denise got incredibly lost and drove around in circles for hours before she arrived in Carlisle, it seems extremely unlikely that she could have tabulated an additional 700 miles. But we'll get back to that momentarily. Right now, let's look at Denise's possible movements after she checked into the motel. According to Melissa, Denise said she was planning to go eat at a nearby McDonald's before she went back to her room to get some sleep. And the last confirmed sighting of her was from the motel owner, who said Denise asked to borrow some matches sometime between 6:30 and 7 p.m. The owner also confirmed receiving a call from Melissa in which she asked for directions to the motel, and phone records show that there was a total of 4 calls made from Melissa's home to Denise's room at 5:59, 6:06, 6:13, and 6:59. While we can't 100% confirm that Denise went to McDonald's, French fries and wrappers from the restaurant were found inside the vehicle. But the big unanswered question is whether or not she returned to her room after she left. There is a record of a phone call from the room to Melissa's home at 8:05 p.m., but we can't be certain if Denise actually made it. However, there's something definitely off about the call. It takes over 3 hours to drive from North Bergen to Carlisle, and since Melissa arrived sometime between midnight and 1 a.m., this would imply that she did not leave until after the 8:05 phone call. But if Denise phoned Melissa shortly after checking in at 6 o'clock, and told her she would need her help guiding her the rest of the way to North Bergen, why would Melissa wait for a couple of hours before leaving? Well, we know that Denise's possessions were left behind inside the motel room, but the detail which sticks out for me is that her room key was still there as well. This seems to indicate that either A, someone else used the key to enter the room and left it there, or B, Denise was removed from the room by force. I'm inclined to think B, since some of Denise's clothing was on the floor, which seemed to indicate she was in the middle of changing, and there was also a lit cigarette found in the ashtray that was never actually smoked. So Denise could have returned to her room after grabbing something to eat at McDonald's before she was abducted by an unknown party. It's possible that Melissa did not actually have plans to meet Denise at the motel, but someone phoned her from the room at 8:05 and told her something which prompted her to make the drive there. It now seems obvious that Melissa was lying about a number of things, but it's interesting how neither the authorities or Denise's family seemed to be suspicious of her at all at the outset. It's quite jarring to see how much Melissa's attitude changed over the course of a year. If you look at the original media coverage of the case, Melissa has pretty much become a spokesperson for her missing friend, actively participating in the search effort, and constantly putting over what a good person and loving mother Denise is, and how worried she is about her safety. And yet one year later, when police have found discrepancies in Melissa's story, this quote-unquote concerned best friend now tells them she just wants to put the whole incident behind her? When you look at the inconsistencies surrounding Melissa, it's somewhat surprising that it took a while before investigators became suspicious of her. She initially stated that she was with her boyfriend when she traveled to the Pike Motel, but it turned out she was actually accompanied by two casual male acquaintances from the bar she worked at. That's quite a brazen lie to tell, considering that Melissa interacted with the motel owner, who could confirm that she had two men with her, not one. It makes one wonder if Melissa had her reasons for not wanting to mention these guys to the police. Not much information has ever been released publicly about the two men, but it sounds like they were cooperative when they were interviewed by police, and did not give off the impression that they had any direct knowledge or involvement in Denise's disappearance. In fact, they were the ones who shared the odd story about Melissa becoming hysterical when she first noticed that Denise's Plymouth Acclaim was not in the motel parking lot, even though they hadn't even checked inside the room yet. This is especially odd, considering that this was a rental car, and Melissa shouldn't have even known what it looked like unless Denise described it during one of their phone conversations. But it does appear that Melissa may have had additional knowledge about Denise's disappearance she did not share, or she was just trying to put on an act to look like a concerned friend. If I had to guess, I think that when Melissa received the phone call from the motel at 8:05, she may have been given the impression that Denise was in trouble, which prompted her to make the drive to Carlisle. However, because of the potential danger, Melissa did not want to take the trip alone, so she asked two guys from her bar to accompany her as protection, even though they had no knowledge about what was actually going on. The one discrepancy in Melissa's story which is impossible to rectify is the phone call to her voicemail from the market in Middlesex Township at 12:50 a.m. on April 12th. It sounds like this location was in fairly close proximity to the Pike Motel, but the problem is that Denise did not arrive at the Pike Motel until 17 hours later. Melissa always maintained that she had no idea who made the call, but investigators were doubtful it was Denise. This is supported by the fact that Denise made a phone call to Melissa at 6:39 a.m. in Somerset, which is over 100 miles west of Middlesex Township, and in the opposite direction of where Denise was supposed to be traveling to. So if the caller wasn't Denise, it seems like one hell of a coincidence that she would go missing from that exact same area all those hours later, especially since Melissa claimed she had no ties to this region. This lends credence to the idea that Denise did not check into the Pike Motel because she was lost, but had a specific reason for being in Middlesex Township at that time. This is yet another odd discrepancy which has caused speculation that Melissa may have roped Denise into doing something illegal, such as drug trafficking, and had made arrangements for Denise to meet someone at the Pike Motel. But something went horribly wrong, which prompted Melissa to travel to the motel and discover that her friend was no longer there. I guess my biggest problem with this theory is that Melissa did not hesitate to immediately call the police and report Denise missing, and I'm not sure she would have been so quick to involve law enforcement if she was mixed up in something illegal. Whatever the case, Melissa seemed to have reasons for not telling the police the complete truth. So now let's get back to discussing the additional 700 miles found on the rental car's odometer and where they might have come from. We have a fairly detailed record of Denise's movements on April 12th, but not so much on April 11th. All we know is that she made a call to Melissa from Indianapolis, but for all we know, she could have left the interstate and made some detours to other locations that day, allowing her to total up those extra 700 miles. We also know that around 12 hours passed between when Denise arrived at the Pike Motel and her rental car was found abandoned 35 miles away. So someone could have driven the vehicle a great distance over the course of the night before it was left there. Again, I just have my doubts that a person could tabulate all those miles simply from getting lost. But the other big question is, who drove the rental car to that rural location in Perry County on Route 274? What's unique about this situation is that it doesn't look like it was deliberately abandoned at that location. The vehicle simply ran out of gas, and whoever was driving it hightailed it out of there so quickly that they didn't even bother to close the doors behind them. Even though some evidence seems to point towards Denise being forcefully removed from her motel room, I can't discount the possibility that perhaps Denise was driving the car and fleeing for her life from someone until she ran out of gas. When she exited the car and tried to get away on foot, whoever was chasing Denise managed to abduct her, which might explain why her purse was found in a nearby ditch. Of course, if Denise was in danger and trying to get away from someone, it's weird that she would drive to that remote area in the middle of nowhere, 35 miles away from the motel. But it's worth noting that the morning of April the 13th was a very foggy one, so it's certainly possible that Denise, or whoever was driving the vehicle, got lost and had no idea where they were when they ran out of gas. What's interesting is that in many cases in which a missing or murdered victim's vehicle is found, people will take note of where the driver's seat was positioned. For instance, if the victim was a relatively short person, but the seat was pushed all the way back, that might indicate that someone much larger than them was the last person to drive the vehicle. Denise was only 5'6", but they've never released any information about the position of the driver's seat in a rental car, which makes me think there wasn't anything which gave off the impression that someone else was driving it. Of course, if another person was behind the wheel when the car ran out of gas in that remote area in the middle of the night, how did they manage to make it out of the area? We know that Denise had already run out of gas and found herself stranded by the side of the road near Schaeferstown the previous day, so it's certainly possible the same thing could have happened to her again. I wish there was more information about how much fuel Denise got when the motorist pulled over to help her out. Did she fill up her entire tank? We know the vehicle was eventually driven from Schaeferstown to Burnville to Carlisle to Perry County, which is about 125 miles in total, and certainly not enough to burn through an entire gas tank. But of course, we don't know how much additional driving was done, or how much fuel the car even had. Whatever the case, whoever was behind the wheel when it did run out of gas seemed pretty desperate to get out of the area quickly. I have to admit that trying to figure out how that rental car wound up at the location it did has left me pretty stumped. At the very least, we know that Denise and the vehicle were already gone when Melissa arrived at the Pike Motel between midnight and 1 a.m, but that doesn't necessarily mean the car was already abandoned by that point. The fact of the matter is that we technically only have Melissa's word about what Denise said to her during their final phone call together. The official story is that Denise checked into that motel simply because she was lost, tired, and needed a place to sleep, but there's definitely a lot to suggest that she was in Carlisle for a specific reason. But one more thing we should address is the strange phone call which took place 7 months later. As you recall, the wife of Mike Douglas, the man whom Denise had been having an affair with, claimed that Denise phoned her and asked her to tell Mike that she was not coming home because she had gotten married. Now, Denise's affair with this married man is not an angle which has been thoroughly explored in most of the media coverage of this case, though I have a feeling we would have learned more details if the story had been featured on Unsolved Mysteries, as they were apparently planning to interview Mike Douglas for the segment. As it is, I'm not entirely sure if the affair between Denise and Mike was still going on at the time she disappeared, and it's unclear whether Mike's wife or anyone else found out about the affair before or after Denise went missing. But given that Denise was unemployed, and Mike owned the airport where she used to work, it's reasonable to assume that there may have been some sort of conflict of interest which led to Denise losing her job. All that being said, I seriously doubt that this affair has any connection to the circumstances of Denise's disappearance. Even if it might have given someone a potential motive to abduct and murder her, I seriously doubt this would have happened over 1,000 miles and several states away. I do believe the phone call to Mrs. Douglas did take place, but the caller was definitely not Denise. The most logical explanation is that it was either a prank call, or perhaps it was Melissa impersonating Denise because she wanted to give off the false impression that Denise ran away on her own to start a new life. The one consensus everyone seems to have about Denise is that she dearly loved her son William, and regardless of whatever personal problems she might have had, it's very unlikely she would have taken off without trying to contact him. If Denise was still alive somewhere and had gotten married, how come the only person she contacted was the wife of the man she had once had an affair with? I know Mrs. Douglas apparently seemed certain that it was Denise's voice on the line, but that might be the reason the caller chose to phone her. She wasn't as close to Denise as many of the other people in her life and could have been more easily fooled. No, sadly, I think it's pretty likely that Denise met with foul play on the night she disappeared and someone disposed of her body, but even after all these years, it sounds like investigators have still had a hard time figuring out the exact circumstances of how this might have happened. I definitely think that Melissa Shepherd is the key to figuring everything out, but it sounds like she has also pretty much vanished off the face of the earth. That's not to say she's a missing person per se, or that she became a victim of foul play. The impression I get is that investigators wanted to re-interview her around the 15-year anniversary of Denise's disappearance, but just could not track her down or figure out her current whereabouts. She could very well be out there living a normal life somewhere today, but I'm sure there are a lot of people named Melissa Shepherd in the US. Of course, I don't get the impression that Melissa had any direct involvement in Denise's disappearance, as it sounds like her two male companions pretty much functioned as her alibi witnesses, and could vouch for her whereabouts between when she left North Bergen and when she contacted the police to report Denise missing in Carlisle. But Melissa has been caught in multiple lies, and it's a certainty that she knows more than she's telling, so I think that both she and Denise found themselves in a situation in which they were in way over their heads. It's possible that Melissa has remained silent about certain things for fear of her own life, but given that nearly 25 years have passed, I can hope that one day she might decide to come forward and reveal everything she knows. As it is, Denise's disappearance is still a massive jigsaw puzzle in which a number of the key pieces are missing. It was really sad to read the anniversary article about the case last year and see a current photograph of her son William with his fiancée, as it sounds like he's done pretty well for himself, but still had to grow up without a mother. So Denise's entire family really deserves to know what happened to her. If you happen to have any information about the unsolved disappearance of Karen Denise Wells, please contact the Pennsylvania State Police at 717-249-2121. That's 717-249-2121. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've released some exclusive bonus episodes for our donors in tiers 2 and 3, and our most recent Patreon episode was titled The Trail Went Hot, which explored some of the many cold cases which were solved in 2018. And we'll be releasing another exclusive bonus episode later this month. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to give a special shout out to all our most recent listeners who have signed up to support us on Patreon this past week, and they are Colleen C, Katie B, Suzanne K, Valerion, Laura B, Jody P, Johnny B325, Vince J, Bonnie K, Claire D, and Catherine C. Thank you all so much for your support. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, which has a number of interesting threads about this case. Need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.